All right. Today is September 30th, 2020. I'm Ethan Sharp. I'm here in Lexington, Kentucky, and I'm talking with Alex Elswick, who is, you're also in Lexington, I assume.
Yes.
Okay. So Alex, we're here today to talk about primarily events that are going on this year and how they're impacting the recovery community. But I would like for you to tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, where you grew up, and your personal journey through recovery and into leadership roles in the recovery community.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to sit down with you, first of all. My name is Alex, and I'm born and raised in Lexington, Kentucky, and born to a really privileged circumstance, which, as it turns out, is really relevant to my whole recovery trajectory. My mom was an accountant, my dad's a doctor. Was never neglected or abused or anything like that. I just had a great childhood, and but I've got a lot of addiction in my extended family. Probably an inherited genetic predisposition, and then have multiple anxiety disorders, and have struggled with anxiety from the time that I was really young. And I think looked for ways to cope, and found that drugs work pretty well, at least in the short
Yeah.
term. And I ended up going to college to play baseball, and got arrested on a bunch of drug trafficking charges, and got kicked off the team, got kicked out of school. Got put on probation, and then a couple months into probation, had surgery to have my wisdom teeth removed. Got prescribed an opioid. Got addicted to it, which is of like the sort of the stereotypical trajectory of the opioid epidemic. I ended up, going in and out of treatment. Made the switch to heroin later on. I ended up homeless in a few different cities and sleeping under a bridge. And I ended up. Really, what my recovery started at a Salvation Army, which is a homeless shelter in Dayton. And I spent 6 months there. And then I did some intensive outpatient programs and worked with a therapist and had a hell of a lot of support, and a hell of a lot of second chances and opportunities and privileges and just all the things. So it's been a little over 7 years. So September 13th of 2013. And it's just been a really crazy experience. Not something that I ever thought was going to happen to me. But when I got into graduate school, I guess my research has always started with this basic question, which is why is it that I'm here and my friends are not? Because we tell a lot of stories about why people recover from substance use disorder, but I'm not sure that the data back up a lot of those stories. And so I was really wondering, I really meant that in a sincere way. Why are some of my friends in a cemetery and some are at the ER and some are in a jail cell and I'm in graduate school, And so that's when I stumbled across the concept of recovery capital, which we can talk more about. But basically, I just came to really understand the privileges and the opportunities that I've been given and how that shaped my recovery experience and my success in recovery. So we decided we wanted to provide that in our community. And that's what where kind of the genesis of Voices of Hope came from. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, can you talk a little bit about your involvement in starting Voices of Hope? I think I didn't know if you were going there, but I
No,
just
yeah,
wanted
that's great.
to.
You're good. You're good to jump in so I don't get
Okay.
lost, go off on a tangent. So Voices started really like shoestring grassroots. Myself, my mom, and a professor in the College of Nursing, Amanda Fallon Bennett, who is today absolutely one of my best friends in the world. I just bought a car a little while back, and I pre-programmed my mom, my dad, and Amanda, and that's it, into the car because those are the
That's
only people that matter.
awesome.
And we started out doing like naloxone distribution. Really, what we started out doing was basing our services on my own experience. So my mom had tried to get naloxone and couldn't get it at the pharmacy, and they had told her she was going to have to buy it in bulk, and just she faced all these barriers. And so we said, all right, that's one barrier that we can eliminate. So we started writing grants to provide naloxone in the community, doing overdose response trainings. We started doing a lot of speaking, just aimed at kind of raising awareness and reducing stigma. My buddy Josh Nadsom wrote an article early on and described us as a like a dog and pony show or something. So
we laugh and just say, you know, Alex and his mother traveled the state. And then we were starting to decide, like, we want to be intentional about what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so we traveled to the Northeast to a place called CCAR in Connecticut, and Anchor mm-hmm. in Rhode Island, which are recovery community centers, mm-hmm. And just learned about the model and
right.
just walked in the door, and we were like, oh shit, we need this.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. So we just kind of came back to Lexington and met as a board and had a 3-year plan. A 5-year plan to establish our RCO. Our 3-year goal was kind of ambitious. And less than a year later, we had a physical space and we were on our way.
Yeah. Can you talk about sort of what the vision of an RCO is, a recovery community organization?
Yeah, we currently have this treatment model where we take people out of their community, out of their home, to send them to treatment in most cases. And a much better model, and a model that's just sort of organic that makes sense, is providing people with the treatment, the management, the resources, all the things in their community. So we don't have to rip up the plant, feed it somewhere else, and then try to replant it. And so that's what a recovery community center does, is it's the hub of all things recovery in the community. So it's a space where people come to meetings. And oh, by the way, they're not just 12-step meetings. There are dozens of different meetings to mm-hmm. support all pathways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we provide then mostly peer support services, peer delivered services. We support research, do a lot of community education, that kind of thing.
And when did you sort of formally become an RCO?
Yeah, not until 2000 and I think 2018. So we've been working since 2015, but I think we formalized in 2017 and got our space in 2018. So.
Okay. Great. So maybe we could go back to sort of your journey as a graduate student and mm-hmm. how that's informed your work with Voices yeah. and other organizations.
Yeah. With all sincerity, what an incredible privilege it is to get to go to school and to get to just pore over books all day long. And it's exactly what you ask for when you talk about looking for a job that's something that you care about, something that'll pay you. Something that, you know, all those things, you know, like I've found it. So I get to marry all the research that I do in graduate school with really fundamentally what we're about at Voices, with the work that I do in my job as professor. So it just all comes together. So our research focuses a lot on peers and how peers are used and the effectiveness of peer-based recovery support services. But I also focus a lot of my work on recovery capital, on understanding asset building, kind of taking the focus off of trying to make everybody be abstinent and being so worried about how much people are putting in their body and, you know, so focused on the drugs and the pathology mm-hmm. and the potential of recovery. So kind of an asset strengths-based approach, that kind of thing.
Okay. And what program did you study in? And then... What is your work now? And then we'll come back maybe to recovery capital.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So my master's was in a clinical program, a marriage and family therapy program.
Okay.
I didn't really even know what I was getting myself into when I applied. I only applied to one school. I applied there and just knew that I wanted to work with families in addiction and learn so much from that experience. My outlook on life, my politics, everything changed really fundamentally.
Yeah. Wow.
And then I got a little taste of research, got to do a master's thesis and got to explore recovery capital among 25-year-olds and got to publish a paper and just to be a part of all of that and realize I'm a nerd for research.
Yeah. Awesome.
I went into the doctoral program there. It's in the Department of Family Sciences. And my dissertation focused on, it was a randomized controlled trial of one of our programs, our telephone recovery support program.
Oh, at Voices. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so then I finished that in the midst of COVID this year, defended my dissertation.
Oh, you did. Oh, yes. Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. It was a wild experience. And so currently, I serve at University of Kentucky as an assistant professor for substance use prevention and recovery. It's actually my title.
Yeah. And did your dissertation address recovery capital then? Was that a major theme?
Yes. So,
okay, so you want to talk about that?
Been a major theme in all the research. Yeah. So I guess one of the things I'll say is when I got to graduate school and I was trying to ask that question, why am I here? Why did I make it, you know, to this point? Friends didn't. I stumbled across, totally as a matter of happenstance, Recovery Capital, an article about Recovery Capital. And it's one of those things where as soon as I read it, I knew it intuitively to be true. You know what I mean? I read it and I thought, that is just truth written in words. and so Recovery Capital, by definition, refers to all the resources, both inside of a person and outside of a person, that you can use to support your recovery. And so it's usually divided into personal, social, and community recovery capital. So personal recovery capital is physical things. So you can think of like having stable housing, being food secure, having education, having health insurance, having all those physical resources. It's also human capital. So it's things like self-efficacy. It's things like your mental health. Then social recovery capital are all things interpersonal. So if you families, members that are supportive of your recovery, what the environment, and then community recovery capital is like time and place. When and where are you recovering? How does that impact your recovery? What's the state of stigma in the community in which you recover? Those kind of things. It's really a whole much more holistic way of looking at recovery. And as I started to understand that, really, I think the shortcut way to understand recovery capital is its privilege in the context of recovery. So if you understand privilege, that's what recovery capital is. And I'll give you some examples. Like we always think when we think of recovery resources of housing and all the standard things. But when I left the Salvation Army, I had, you know, bad credit, a lot of debt. I had huge gaps in my employment history. I had no college degree, no marketable skills, no reason that anybody should actually employ me.
Right. And
my dad had a friend who had a guy who was a patient, who was willing, you know, so leveraging a social relationship to get a job that I didn't earn by merit. Those are the kind of things that those reciprocal social relationships, those are the kind of things that some people have in recovery that, that make a significant difference, right?
Yeah.
That others don't have. So I started learning about that as a part of my master's thesis. And then I learned as we went to CCAR in Connecticut and Anchor in Rhode Island and started studying the RCO model, I learned that it's actually predicated on recovery capital.
Yeah.
And it just, I didn't even realize anyone else had heard of recovery capital and then learned that the entire model was, and so we realized we are doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing.
Right. And can you talk about how revolutionary that is within the recovery field?
I mean,
I'll let you address that if you can.
There's a lot about it that's revolutionary. I think the easiest way to explain that is just to think about where it came from. So recovery capital, there's a guy named William Cloud who's working on his doctoral dissertation in the 1970s, and he studied a bunch of college students. And what he noticed is even these students who had really severe problems with substances in school seemed to be graduating and going back to their communities and getting jobs and never going to treatment. And he just noticed that that really didn't fit kind of the story that we tell about addiction and recovery. And so he started building this idea that it must be about this social capital that they enjoy. And then he went to teach later on at the University of Denver and met a guy named Robert Granfield, who was also teaching at that university. And they found out they were using the same textbook for their classes. And so long story short, they became friends. And over a family barbecue, they're having a discussion about this, and Granfield says to Cloud, well, it's not just this social capital. It's everything. It's recovery capital.
Yeah.
So recovery capital is based on what's called natural recovery, which is unassisted recovery. Mm-hmm. And so the story we tell about addiction and recovery is generally that people have to hit rock bottom, and then they have to go to treatment, and then they have to abstain in order to get well. And when you look at big epidemiological studies, what you find is the majority of people don't take an abstinence-based path, and the majority of people will not go to treatment.
Yeah.
And the reason for that, the explanation for that is these people have recovery capital. They don't have a need for treatment because they have the things that they need to support them on their journey.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that topic, but I guess we should move on to other things. But there's a lot we could talk about, obviously, with that. So let's talk about the work that you're doing now. So you're working at UK, and but you're also invited to speak, and you're sort of a well-known advocate. Can you talk a little bit about those activities?
Yes. Gratefully, the job that I have at UK as a professor is only a small amount of teaching and research, and the majority of my time is dedicated to being in the community.
Yeah.
So really doing a lot of interfacing with communities who are working on how do we build a recovery ready community? What does that look like? And I get the opportunity to work through our extension system, through the land grant extension system, to do all kinds of things. So I work with our nutrition specialists on building nutrition curricula for treatment centers. And then we work with, we just got a SAMHSA grant to write a financial literacy curriculum for people in recovery that we call recovery. And it's tailored to like, what if they garnish my bills while I'm in jail and all these financial issues that people don't usually think of. So it's really cool to be in a multidisciplinary setting where I get to apply addiction expertise to all the other things, all the ways we can support people. And in fact, what we're doing when we do that is building recovery capital.
Yeah. Yeah. And the judge mentioned you're also, there was, I sort of missed this, but there was this new project that you were starting. I don't know if I'm, is that the one that he was talking about, that SAMHSA grant?
Well, no, this is actually something different. So I reached out to judge, formed a partnership with the Administrative Office of the Courts through a drug court judge named Judge Privet, who is very much a recovery friendly judge.
Yeah.
A progressive judge in that sense, if you ask me. And so for the three counties where he does drug court, we brought to bear recovery capital, basically. We took all of the work that we do in family and consumer sciences extension and applied it, brought those resources to the folks in the drug court program. So they came to the extension office every other week. And on a rotating basis, we had them meeting with nutritionists, meeting, you know, dietitians, meeting with financial experts, meeting with, you know, people who can come in to do expungements, like all the things, right? Just
Right. Basically
saying if recovery capital is what people need to sustain recovery, then let's bring it home.
Yeah. And things that Voices of Hope have really evolved. And could you talk a little bit about the new things that have started there too?
Yeah. So when we started out, when we came back to Lexington after making the tours and kind of put together our plan, we started doing our first service even before we had a physical space. So our first service was a program called Telephone Recovery Support. Kind of flips the sponsorship model on its head. So instead of you calling a sponsor when you're getting tight, we call at designated times. And it's a really person-centered phone call. How's your recovery going today? And just have a conversation with folks. And so we started running that program out of my mom's attic, out of her bonus room. The growth has exploded. We were really fortunate to get a hold of some grant dollars at a time, in a timely manner. And we've really expanded. So now we have about a half a dozen recovery coaches who do a number of things. They do one-on-one recovery coaching sessions, which the basic idea is building recovery capital, is sitting down with a person and saying, what do you need? How can I help you with your recovery? What are the barriers? And helping them work through that. We have a coach who works at an ER in Lexington through Voices of Hope. So does, you know, ED referrals, that kind of thing. We have a harm reduction coach who focuses on harm reduction services. We're very fortunate to be selected as a part of the HEAL study, the Healing Community Study. And so through that, we've expanded to potentially the 16 counties as a part of the group. And then we host, like I said, we host dozens of different meetings every week. A lot of those have had to go, well, they've all virtually had to go virtual because of COVID. We just started a new meeting a couple weeks ago that I'm really excited about called Harm Reduction Works. A meeting for people who are actively using, for people who are abstinent, for everyone in between. It's a really cool space. What else have we been doing?
What is the focus of harm reduction? I mean, how is it different from some of the other groups?
Yeah. So most recovery programs are abstinence based. That comes from partly our historical view of like sobriety as virtue, but also from like the 12-step community. And in reality, so I'll tell you something really interesting. There are about 23 million people who are addicted in the United States right now, and only about 2.3 million will receive services this year. So that's 10%. And so we all say that there's a 90% treatment gap. And we always talk about the treatment gap. We need more beds because the treatment gap. But if you do a deeper dive on that data and you ask those 90% who won't receive treatment this year why they won't receive treatment, the majority of them say because they don't want to be abstinent, right? And so if abstinence is the only path we have to helping people get better,
right,
it's not working for everybody. So harm right. is really a way of taking the focus off of how much drugs are being used or if drugs are being used and putting the focus on the harm that is being caused. So how do we reduce? Yeah. And a good example is the face masks that we're all wearing. We've all said, hey, we can't stay home forever. We have to go out in society a little bit, but we're going to wear masks while we do it to reduce the harm.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. Was there anything else that you were going to think of that Voices of Hope is doing currently?
We're doing like a book club for people in recovery. We do sober social events. We did sober tailgates all last year. We've been really fortunate to be visited by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Lazar, NIH, by everybody. Yeah. So we think we're a big deal. Our head's growing.
Yeah, I think you are a big deal too. So yeah. Well, let's talk about the impact of the pandemic on you know people who are struggling with opioid use disorder, people in recovery, maybe they're just getting started in recovery, or maybe we could also address people in long-term recovery, how the pandemic has affected them and the organizations that support them. So it's a sort of broad question. We can walk through some of the different initiatives you've been involved in and how they've been impacted and how you've adjusted, to the pandemic.
I think in order to understand how the pandemic has impacted this recovery community, you got to think first about where we were right before the pandemic, which we were already in a really bad place, right?
Yeah.
2017, we had a record number of overdoses. 2018 was a slight reduction, which we celebrated. We thought we turned the tide. But then 2019 was a slight increase. And 2020, as it turns out, is going to be the record year. It's going to be a bad one like we've not seen. So, we already had an opioid epidemic, sort of coming to this. We're seeing the rise of methamphetamine again. And then COVID hit and people in recovery, people who use drugs, people with substance use disorders are so incredibly vulnerable in so many different ways. And as a society, we so become hyper-focused on their drug use and all of their problems to their drug use and don't acknowledge that this is a population that has a disproportionate number of mental disorders, a disproportionate share of traumatic experiences, a disproportionate economic challenges down the line. So it's been really hard on my people, It's been really hard.
And when, just to clarify, so the statistics you were looking at for the opioid epidemic are overdose deaths, hospitalizations,
emergency department visits, ambulance runs.
Okay.
Yeah. So when we compare 2020 data, I think the data I have currently was just based on the first 5 months of 2020. Yeah. So not completely current, but relatively so. And it's horrific to look at the graph.
Yeah.
Especially keeping in mind that 2018 and 2019 were already such bad years.
Yeah.
So the huge spike of 2020 beyond them, you have to keep in mind that's relative to already a really bad year.
Yeah. Right. And, how does that impact services that, people were getting? I know you mentioned that, Voices of Hope has adjusted. But if you take a sort of a broader view, maybe people were doing outpatient treatment. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't show up for their appointments. I don't know if you could sort of address the issue of them getting the services that they need.
We had a lot of different issues. So when it comes to like inpatient treatment providers, you have the issue of, can they take new admissions? Do they have to be COVID cleared? All those kind of issues. I had a guy who we were working with who was at a treatment center where he was supposed to phase up, where he's supposed to have some more freedom, some more, you know, privileges, and COVID hit and they put everything on shutdown. And because he didn't get, you know, to have the freedom that he had earned, he left the treatment center and don't know where he is currently, you know, so it's an example. I know that a lot of shelters weren't taking folks in for a time. The emergency shelter weren't taking new admissions. And for a while, NIDA had recommended outpatient treatment over inpatient treatment, all things being equal, because in general, research shows no particular preference in terms of outcomes when it comes to outpatient or inpatient.
Right.
So, you know, trying to keep people from to social distance. But I think the biggest impact really has been on community-based recovery support services, which are so much more predicated on social connection, which are peer-based, which are really like, you know, your meeting space is your sanctuary. It's your it's your anchor. It's your touchstone for the week. And so to take a people, a population that are so vulnerable, and to take away what is probably their most significant support system is really problematic. So fortunately for us at Voices, first of all, we had the telephone recovery support program,
right,
which was sort of ran uninterrupted, which is a term really good. And then we were concerned about what it would be like to turn meetings virtual. But as it turns out, you know, we haven't done any research on it yet. And there is a little bit of research on these services. But they seem to be working well. People seem to feel connected and to feel like it's a meaningful social interaction, even though it's through Zoom. So that's been a positive. It's a silver lining. The other thing that I've seen that I would say is really a positive is we've seen a little more focus on harm reduction, a little shift away from our abstinence obsession, and a little shift towards the recognition that at this time, during this pandemic, during this epidemic inside this pandemic, maybe it's a time to not be so staunch and to start worrying about just saving lives. So for instance, we've seen the relaxation of some protocols and policies surrounding medication for opioid use disorder, like methadone and Suboxone. And I think in general, making those more widely available, more accessible is just life-saving.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And so when you switch to online meetings, so the attendance has pretty much been consistent through that Voices of Hope for that?
To be honest, just to answer the question directly, it wasn't. We had an initial dip where people really weren't engaging with much of anything, which is really, that's when we panicked. What's going to happen?
Right.
People, what's happened, you know, to our people. But yeah, we've seen it pick up and we've got a number of different meetings that go virtually every week. Some of our meetings are hybrid, so we'll have some folks who want to come in. The regulations, the number of people you're allowed to have in the room is so few. So
Right. And your sense that, you know, the 12-step meetings that, you know, that take place in churches or the Celebrate Recovery meetings, these are things I didn't even think of. Did they switch to virtual or do you have a sense of some just closed?
Yeah, just depends. Some just had to shut down. A lot have gone virtual. I think a lot of us just didn't realize how seamless it could be to go virtual. We just haven't tried it yet. And we are a population very resistant to change, you know, notoriously. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not on board with the virtual either, but here we are.
Yeah.
So how did the pandemic affect these, you know, these other things that you were working on, you know, your advocacy across the state and beyond, your project with Judge Privet, your SAMHSA project, all those things get put on hold? Or
fortunately, we get some extensions on the grants. That's not universal, but we have for the two grants that I'm working on, which is great. But we've still been able to kind of do our thing. We just had one of our trainings for recovering your finances recently. That's gone. We had initially planned to start a new round of the Beyond program, which is that partnership with Drug Court, with Judge Privet.
Right.
Okay. We planned to start a new round in January, but that obviously was interrupted by COVID. And so I think that's sort of characteristic of what you're seeing everywhere, is just the interruptions in service and these services that are so critical for people,
right.
You know, during this time. But at Voices, we've been able to adapt a little bit more. And in some ways, I think that's the value, one of the strengths of a peer-based recovery center, because we're not professionals and because we aren't beholden to licensure and credentials, we can kind of move fast. And that's been a benefit for us.
Right. Right. And can you clarify that a little bit more, sort of how you have more flexibility?
Yeah, because our peers don't have, I mean, so I guess to be specific, we have some peers who are hired under grants and we really don't have flexibility as that goes. They have a
role
to play. But those that we hire on our own really can fill different roles. So if we need somebody to facilitate a meeting online, they can do that. It's expanded our reach for recovery coaching considerably because we're able to do the recovery coaching virtually. And insofar as we can tell, it seems to be going well. So it just seemed like because we weren't bound by much, you know, we were just sort of able to adapt and kind of move quickly.
Right. Is there any other data or personal stories, anecdotes that you could share about the pandemic and its impact on the recovery community? If not, that's fine. I just thought I'd give you that opportunity.
Sure. No, it's great. I collected some data right before COVID. Well, the onset of COVID, January of 2020. So January this year, I collected some data at an outpatient treatment center in central Kentucky, and half of my sample was unemployed and 75% of my sample was living below the federal poverty level. And that's pre-COVID really.
It
kind of gives you a picture of the socioeconomic stress that recovery must be under. And then at a time when unemployment rises and the job market gets tighter, the first people to get squeezed out are people who don't have college degrees, people who have criminal records, people who, right? I mean, they're just the most vulnerable. They're really on the fringe.
Yeah. And so you haven't sort of gotten the data post pandemic yet, but we can assume that things aren't going well. Well, where do you see things sort of going? I mean, there's a lot of, as you mentioned, you know, maybe a bit more acceptance of harm reduction measures. Mm-hmm. The online seems to be working. Where do you see things sort of going from here as things slowly return to normal? Do you see recovery community coming back stronger and these initiatives being more effective? Or,
you know, what do you see? My gut is to say no, and that's pessimism.
Okay.
I know.
Okay.
But really, I think we're frightfully, we've been frightfully slow to respond to the opioid epidemic meaningfully. We're slow to look to science to give us the answers on what we should actually be doing. It's too political. It's too all these things. And so already, I think the recovery from the coronavirus is, and I don't even know that we've begun a period that we can even call recovery from that yet.
Right.
So,
right.
I think this is really the way we're looking at it is this is the new normal. We're not looking at like what's to come next. We're just kind of like, hey, what does it look like to adjust to this if this mm-hmm. needs to happen indefinitely? So it's a challenge because you kind of have to grieve the loss of the meeting spaces you love, all the things that you love to do. But we've got to adapt. And I'll tell you the other thing I would say, not to be hokey, but people in recovery have experienced so much trauma, so much strife, so much pain, so much adversity, that we're survivalists, really. You know, that's kind of what we know how to do is survive. And so I think mm-hmm. there's something about that that maybe gives people in recovery a leg up during this time where everyone's having to try to figure out what does survival look like for me now. This is kind of our natural habitat.
Yeah. Let me just pick up on a thing that you mentioned there. What is sort of your vision of, you know, I'll say us, but I mean the government and the communities around the state. What is your vision of us dealing effectively with the opioid epidemic? What is needed there?
Yeah, I think the first thing is a shift completely away from focusing on abstinence. We have a whole system that's predicated on the need for abstinence. Our whole treatment paradigm is we send everybody to inpatient treatment or outpatient treatment where we coerce abstinence. If you're not abstinent, then you're not compliant and you're no longer welcome in treatment. So we kick people out, right? And abstinence right. is a precondition for housing. Abstinence is a precondition for social services. In some cases, it's a precondition for mental health services. I had a therapist tell me he couldn't begin to address my addiction.
Wow.
Address my anxiety until I address my addiction. To which I said, well, I'm not going to be able to stop using until you, right? So there, abstinence is like a barrier to all of these things, when the grand irony is the research tells us all of those things might actually help someone become abstinent. My vision for the future is this is what I've been calling it the last 3 days. I don't know what it will be, is assets, not abstinence. So really focusing on what do people need to be cared for to be well? You know, you think of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and people have been screaming about this since the beginning of time. For some reason, we just seem to regard people who are addicted differently. In reality, what people need are the same things, right? So they need all their physiological needs met. They need to be a part of something. They need reciprocal obligations. They need support. Some need treatment, but as it turns out, it's a select few who actually need to be intervened on. And the majority need support.
Right. And your idea was that we would need more recovery community organizations.
Yes.
On the state.
My idea there is the big, you know, in the 1980s and before, the sort of focus of addiction treatment was a jail cell. That's what we did with people, locked them up.
Right.
In like the 90s, 2000s, now we've sort of shifted to like we send people to treatment, and that's kind of the focus is in residential treatment centers or outpatient treatment centers. My vision is the focus, the place where people are getting well, is in their community, right?
Yeah.
They're not, you know, some with severe substance use disorders or complex mental health profiles may need inpatient treatment. The vast majority just need support right where they are.
Yeah. This may be a bit of a curveball, but I don't know if you can talk about sort of how other events that have taken place in 2020 sort of intersect with things you've been involved in. So, that could be the protests, it could be the political campaigns, or it's sort of an open question if you want to add anything there.
So, you know, one of the things we've been exploring at Voices is how do we be anti-racist and do better about promoting diversity within our organization, about meeting the need within diverse communities. And as a part of that, we've done a training with a consultant, and we were sort of identifying where do we need to push back against our privilege and where do we need to stand up? And we decided, or we're in the early stages of deciding, I'm pushing really the focus on the war on drugs, because that's the intersection between racism and our world. And they're really inseparable. So I'm reading Chasing the Scream right now. Have you read that book?
I'm gonna read that.
Yeah, you gotta read it. It's phenomenal. And it really explains the extent to which our drug policy really is predicated on racism. It really, in the beginning, was not founded on a fear of the harm of drugs so much so as the fear of the harm of immigrants and people who have a darker skin tone. So, I think that's we need to redress what's been wronged there. I mean, it's been well documented how different the approach to the opioid epidemic has been than the crack epidemic. And so there are so many hurts there that need to be reconciled. And statistically, it's ridiculous the number of people that we incarcerate for drug crime relative to other countries. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It is a broken system, and it's a broken system that is so clearly disproportionately targeting people who don't look like me. So that's we're starting to move into a space where we've been doing a lot of virtual town halls during COVID on different issues to raise, to talk about harm reduction, bring in experts, that kind of thing. So I think the next thing is going to be to start some town halls talking about the war on drugs and how we've been affected, the ways that people who use drugs have been targeted. So we could go on and on, but that's kind of the intersection we see and where we feel like we have an obligation.
And politically, you find that you get support from, for, more resources for addressing the opioid epidemic. Is that, is there sort of broad consensus on that issue, or are you still encounter barriers there?
Yes, that more resources can be gotten, yes, but not necessarily the right resources. I think we first of all, we spend so much money on interdiction, on intercept the drug supply, which we should have learned by now that prohibitions don't work, and every society since the beginning of time has used drugs. So that's not going to be terribly effective. But also, we funnel so many resources into primary treatment, into acute treatment services where somebody's going to be there for a week or 30 days or whatever it is, which is so problematic when what we know is that what people have is a chronic disorder. This is a problem that they're going to struggle with over the long term. So really what I'm saying is give me more of the money, not anyone else. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, I think we're kind of winding down here, but maybe sort of following up on that question, one of the things, I don't know if we brought this up, that Voices of Hope does try to connect folks to employment opportunities. Am I right about that? So that's sort of a way of addressing that piece of recovery capital and sort of very, sort of an essential piece of, addressing the broader epidemic. So I don't know if you can talk about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so first of all, when we evaluate all our programs, one of the things we're evaluating is the extent to which we're building recovery capital. So just like you said, so our employment readiness program, one of the things we've noticed among people in recovery is that they don't have a professional experience. They haven't had the privilege of spending time in professional environments where they learn how you write an email and how you write a cover letter and how you do all the things, how you behave in the professional workplace. And there are so many talented, brilliant people in recovery who could do incredible things if it weren't for that barrier, that cultural barrier.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what the employment readiness program is about. It's folks who are, in many cases, to traditional society, unemployable. But we bring them on. You find assets because we're asset based. So we're not saying what's wrong with you. We're saying what's right with you. And how can they be used, right? And and so all of our, so far we're batting 1,000. I think we've had 3 employment interns and all have gone on to employment.
Yeah.
And I think 2 of them have gone on to employment in the field, which is really cool. So it's been
Yeah. Yeah, great. Well, maybe to end on a positive note, I don't know if there's any stories of that you'd like to share of someone who's done really well through programs that you've worked on or anything, something like that.
I'll share with you one of my favorites, and it's my favorite because we had nothing to do with the success.
Okay.
We had a guy early on come into Voices who hadn't had a job for more than 6 months over a 10-year period, and he'd had a long, long addiction. And when he came to us, he met with a recovery coach, and, we really thought he needed to go to treatment because that seemed to be, what was best for him. And we sent him to treatment. He left after a week, and that's frustrating, but you also recognize there could be any number of reasons for that. We met with him again, and he just really wasn't ready to go to treatment. And he kept saying, "I want to get my teeth fixed." And we're like, "Yeah, we'll help you get your teeth fixed, but you got to get sober first." So then we sent him, to meet with a therapist, and he goes to the therapist one session, won't come back. And, we're like, we got to get you help. And he's like, "Yeah, I really just want to get my teeth fixed." And so around and around it goes, long story short, we end up just saying, "Okay, we'll throw in and help you get your teeth fixed." And it was a heck of a procedure, and he shows up about a week later, and he says, great big smile on his face, right? He's just beaming with gratitude and thank you. And we're like, "Oh, it's no big deal." And he says, "No, you don't understand. I passed a lady walking her dog on the way here, and she smiled at me." And he said, "It's the first time someone smiled back at my smile in, 10 years. And so still we're like, "Oh, that's great. We're glad that we could be a part of that." But still, you have this life-threatening addiction that long story short, he never went to treatment. He never met with another therapist. What happened was he got his smile. And he got his you know, his self-esteem. He got to be what it turns out that every time he went into therapy, he was self-conscious about his teeth. And so he didn't want to have a conversation. He wanted to open his mouth.
Right. Wow.
Right. So it's the ultimate story. It's like a microcosm of person-centered care. This guy was telling us what he needed. And as soon as he got it, he got well. So there's hope. I think if we listen to people, if we give them what they need, they get well.
Yeah. I love that. That's awesome. Well, thank you, Alex, and I will I'll be in touch about the other things that we talked about before we started recording. I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add for perspectives on 2020.
It's been a heck of a year, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has. Yeah. It really has been.
No, I think that pretty well covers it.
Okay, yeah, that was awesome. Thank you so much, Alex, and I'll be in touch.
It sounds good. Thanks, man.
Okay, thanks.